This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. It's wintertime, maybe you don't feel like dragging yourself out of the house to get groceries, but what if those groceries could come to you? For 50% off your first week of meals, go to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter. This episode is also sponsored by Second City, which is the largest school for improv and sketch comedy in the world. Second City offers courses in everything from stand-up classes for beginners to improv for anxiety. And if you don't want to commit to a class, they have two-hour drop-ins where you can test it out. Check out all their classes at secondcity.com/TC. From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani.
The easiest way to start to make something that sounds like, you know, wind or waves is you take this amplifier that we're using to listen to the noise source and you just modulate its amplitude. So as the wave increases in intensity, it opens up the amplifier and lets the sound through. And as it goes down in intensity, it closes and closes the amplifier. If I turn the frequency up, it does this more frequently because now it's hitting its maximum more frequently.
This is Paul Finley. He's got a PhD in nuclear physics, and he's been playing guitar for 25 years. But the thing that put him on the path to becoming a synthesizer enthusiast was this remix of a Chemical Brothers song by the Micronauts from 2007.
It's got this drum loop that slowly morphs into just noise, but with this like the same loop and everything, and then slowly over top of that, a new beat comes on. But I had never really heard anything like that before. I was just like, I need to know how they did that. How do you make those sounds, basically? And that was it.
He bought himself his first synthesizer. It was called an ARP Axe with two X's, and you could only play one note at a time. He tinkered with it for a while, but it had a pretty limited range. So he sold that synth for another one, traded some in, bought some more, and he slowly fell into the world of modular synthesizers. Over time, he built up to the room we were standing in, a small condo office space that kind of looked like a county museum for modular synths. And if you haven't seen one of these things before, the most recognizable comparison I can think of is those old telephone switchboard cabinets where an operator had to sit there and patch you through to the person you were calling. The modular synthesizer was invented in the mid-60s, on opposite sides of the United States, by two people who didn't know about each other. One of them was this guy, Don Buchla. Buchla was a musician who studied physics at UC Berkeley, and he got a Rockefeller grant to make an electronic instrument for live performance. So he did, and he gave it the catchy name, Buchla 100 Series Modular Electronic Music System. When Buchla started manufacturing modular synthesizers for commercial sale, he didn't want to call them synthesizers. And that's because he thought it made them seem like they were supposed to be imitating existing instruments. What he wanted was for people to come up with entirely new sounds.
His was more exploratory, experimental. He even didn't want to write manuals for his stuff because he didn't want to discourage people from experimenting.
And maybe that resistance to making his instrument more approachable is why the other guy's name became almost interchangeable with the synthesizers you see on stages now. Bob Moog was a physicist too, but he was at Cornell. Moog synthesizer used something called subtractive sound, which means that you start with a tone that's kind of unmusical, and then you pass it through filters to give it a shape. For example, if you pass it through a low-pass filter, it'll let lower frequencies pass and block higher ones. Then, if you run it through an amplifier, you can decide when the amplitude goes on and off. And there are a lot of different ways that it can be on or off.
So this is a square wave.
Okay.
Looks like a square. That's why it's called square wave.
Okay.
So I'll go through the typical wave. So this is square. It's good to start with maybe sine. So a sine wave
is
the...
Is it like wine where you have to move from like light to dark or...
Yeah, kind of actually, because a sine wave is a pure tone. That I was mentioning that, you know, let's do a sine wave. You just get pure harmonics. Nothing extra. Now, it's very, very hard to make a pure sine wave. So you'll always have a little bit of overtones in there. I'm just turning up the frequency now. If any dogs are listening, this is going to get... I won't go too high.
Does it damage ears if you go too high? Or
it's just unpleasant. Yeah. It's just not pleasant. But this is a sine wave. So it's sort of very vanilla. You know, imagine your test tone, right? From, I don't know, BBC or something, right? It's just that pure sound. But sine waves aren't terribly interesting because they don't have all that extra harmonic content. Mm-hmm. But then the other waveforms contain harmonics, which means they don't just have that one frequency. They have additional multiples of that frequency in varying amplitudes. So this is a triangle wave. It's one of my favorite waves. It's more like an oboe. Maybe a little hollow sounding. So if you turn it down.
I don't hear an oboe, but I'll take your word for it.
You would though if it was.
Oh yeah, it's getting there now.
It was oboe-y,
like.
So very different, right? Mm-hmm. It has a different harmonic structure.
In the mid to late 1960s, people had not heard these sounds yet. On August 28, 1969, the Museum of Modern Art held the first live synthesizer performance ever. It was part of their Jazz in the Garden series, and it included performances by more traditional jazz and blues groups like the Muddy Waters Blues Band. On the night of Moog's synth concert, 4,000 people crammed into MoMA's Sculpture Garden. That was four times the number of people who had come for the other shows. And this was experimental sound art. But not everyone loved it. One review said that it had, quote, all the musical persuasiveness of lobotomized Hal in 2001 A Space Odyssey singing on a bicycle built for two. Later that same year, a composer named Wendy Carlos, who was going by Walter Carlos at the time, released an album of Bach pieces that were performed on a Moog synthesizer. It was called Switched on Bach. It sold over a million copies by 1974, and it later became the second classical album in history to go platinum. Switched on Bach made the synthesizer go mainstream, and because Carlos was working with Bob Moog throughout the recording process, testing components and suggesting improvements to the instrument, Switched on Bach also led to Bob Moog's breakthrough invention, the Mini Moog.
I mean, the Mini Moog was a huge deal because instead of having to patch all these things together and have this big system, you had a self-contained box with a keyboard where everything was already pre-patched. They added a pitch wheel, which is a wheel that when you push it forward, it'll raise the pitch. And when you pull it back, it'll drop the pitch. And when it's right in the middle, it keeps it steady. So it seems kind of trivial, but like this didn't exist before. And so now while you're playing your solo, you can actually bend notes on a keyboard. You can't do that on a piano. This is unheard of. Like, you couldn't do that. I mean, everybody used the Mini Moog when it came out. Every single band. It was the first sort of commercial keyboard. We take it for granted now that you can just go into a shop and buy an electronic keyboard, but this was a huge deal at the time.
I wanted to know how people were being introduced to this new instrument, so I asked Paul if he had any old manuals. He pulled out this yellow Duotang filled with 274 photocopied pages of a rare textbook from the 1970s.
It is called Electronic Music, Systems, Techniques, and Controls by Alan Strange. You know, chapter one is preliminary statements about the subject matter, where he really wants to set out what he was trying to accomplish with this book.
What's going on with these, the dedication or the quotes? Can you read these?
Oh, sure. This is Luciano Berio says, one of the most important and fascinating aspects of music is the possibilities of coordinating the different layers of perception. I think that says it all right.
That's
there.
Really compelling. I mean. Yeah. This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Every week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions that take about 30 minutes to make. Okay, so the thing about these recipes is that they're really creative for meals that you can cook in 30 minutes or less. And that's because there are people who are paid to spend hours coming up with these recipes. Like, it's their job. And maybe you're kind of creative too, and you're thinking that you've read enough cookbooks in enough bathrooms over the years to do it yourself. But the difference is, no one's paying you to try and turn a bunch of pallid, truck-ripened, grocery store tomatoes into something you're excited about eating for dinner. So maybe you want to spend your free time and creative energy some other way, like teaching your new dog to moonwalk. It's a thing, look it up. If you're thinking about a great gift for someone who's short on time and needs some help in the kitchen, this is that gift. I want this. Someone, please buy this for me. I can't feed myself. For 50% off your first box, visit HelloFresh.ca/theimposter and enter promo code IMPOSTER when you subscribe. That's HelloFresh.ca/theimposter. This episode is also sponsored by Second City. Second City's been around a long time. Their first theater opened in Chicago in 1959, and it became one of the most influential comedy theaters in the world. There are only two other Second City theaters in North America. One is in LA, and the other one is right here in Toronto. So what are you doing for New Year's? That's a question I'm getting a lot these days, and it's because even though New Year's Eve is a holiday whose only real tradition is 10 seconds long, where you are for those 10 seconds could have far-reaching consequences for the 31,536,000 seconds that make up the next year. And if you're at a sad house surrounded by people you feel lukewarm about, that's what your year is going to look like. Make it easy for yourself and go see Second City's hit show of 2017, Party Today, Panic Tomorrow. I haven't seen this show, but critics say it's really funny. One reviewer said that it'll leave you exhausted from laughing too hard. There are two shows, one at 7 and one at 10 p.m., and the 10 p.m. show includes a countdown to midnight led by the cast with party favors and free champagne. Second City's New Year's shows always sell out, so book your tickets now if you don't want to be disappointed. You can do that at secondcity.com/New Year's.
Living in the midst of all the technical miracles that we have
on July 20th, 1969, CBS broadcasted the Apollo 11 moon landing live with commentary by Walter Cronkite. That broadcast was 6 hours long, and it was a lot of blips and control room sounds. So to keep the people excited, they intermittently played this 6.5-minute montage of footage from space, and it was soundtracked by a composer named Mort Garson from St. John, New Brunswick. Thank you. Mort told the LA Times that the only sounds that go along with space travel are electronic ones, so he used a Moog synthesizer. He made a big symphonic sound for the blastoff, some jazzy things for the zero-G game of catch, psychedelic music for a section that uses negatives and diffuse colors on shots taken inside the ship, and a pretty melody for the moon. He said, after all, it's still a lovely moon. And even though the first synthesizers had hit the market in the mid-60s, they cost the equivalent of about $90,000 today, and they took up the better part of a room. Mort Garson was one of only 28 musicians who owned one.
I went to a convention where they were showing different keyboards and things, and I met Mr. Moog there. So I got very friendly with him, and I brought him over to the house, you know, and I said, I want you to hear some of the things. I got a Moog, and I did some things on him, and I started to play things on his instrument. And he just sat there, didn't say nothing, you know. So finally I said, what do you think, Mr. Moog? He says, do you know any ladies? I almost fell off my chair.
I wanted to know more about this person who took up this strange new instrument at age 40 and then ended up defining its sound. But Mort died in 2008. I found him in this featurette called The Music Man that was made shortly before he died. Here's Mort talking about his songwriting process.
If I get an idea, I'll start a new one, you know, but it has to be a great idea. I live with it. I walk and I sing it. Everybody thinks I'm a little out of it, you know, when I'm walking the streets and la 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 la. And I really sing that loud, you know. Hey, Mort, how you doing? Yeah. Let me hear that. It sounds good. Yeah.
Man, I'm looking at him online in a video that was done in 2008, I guess, just before he died. And boy, it's weird because I really hadn't seen him for years.
That's Chuck Braverman. He's the documentary filmmaker who made that short film that aired during the moon landing. I called him up because I wanted to know what it was like to watch his film as part of this historic moment. And I wanted to hear about Mort. But he didn't remember it happening.
I don't really remember all that much. If you want to know the truth, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to remember as much as I can. But it was, you know, 40-something years ago.
Mm-hmm. So I read him some articles, and that helped jog his memory a bit.
I was just a couple of years out of USC film school. I was kind of the hot, new, young kid filmmaker on the block. And here I was, you know, hiring Mort, who was 20 years my senior. And I had put together this film of all this footage of the spaceships launching and astronauts floating in space. And he produced the soundtrack for it. How I was able to afford him, or why, I can't imagine now looking back. And I guess because of that film, somehow I got onto CBS and used Mort and Mort's music, which was appropriate for the time because it was so far out and unusual and unique and different and exciting. He was making layers of different kinds of sound on top of layers on top of layers. He was way ahead of him, the music industry, in many, many ways.
When you try to imagine what it sounds like to be in space, you might think of something like this. But there isn't actually any sound in space, because you need oxygen to be able to hear sound, or at least we do. And this association that we have is a fabrication that was created by these electronic musicians who came up with the space age. The 1956 sci-fi classic, Forbidden Planet, was the first film in any genre with an entirely electronic score. And it was made by electronic music pioneers, B.B. and Lewis Barron. This was a decade before the synthesizer, so they built their own circuits to make the sounds. B.B. said that their method was to just throw out anything that sounded like a conventional instrument. She said that she just knew instinctively that's what it had to sound like when you're traveling through space. Sputnik launched in 1957, and as the space mission became a national priority for America, the synthesizer provided the soundtrack for Americans to get on board. And in order to be able to picture space, people had to hear it. The future must have seemed like something more knowable back then. We were about to master space, and there was this bizarre machine that would let us shape sound in new and complex ways. And the combination of those two things kind of reads as propaganda now. For the idea that technology could integrate us with the natural world, and that it could be under our control. You can hear that optimism in Mort's music. The sounds were far out, but they were still listenable. And soon Mort was getting paid a lot of money to make synthesizer music for TV commercials.
There were four guys that came out of my studio. They wanted a 5-second commercial. One of the guys said, well, I hear like 5 different instruments. The other guy said, no, not 5, 3, and they should be very close together. And then the boss man of these guys, he said, look, you know, just one note. Now I was getting, I think, $20,000 for this commercial. So I went to the Moog, and I pressed one note down. Ding, this is C. So that's it. And that's what they used. It's a funny business.
Around the same time, there was another school of thought with a totally different approach to the synthesizer. They had an eye to the future, but they were also grappling with the past.
It's mostly Stockhausen, and Karlheinz Stockhausen, whose motivation was to create a music that had never existed before. And the reason for that was that he grew up during the Second World War as a German, and wanted to distance himself from the entire history of Western music. I mean, we made music with stuff that wasn't supposed to be musical instruments at all, things that were supposed to be designed for testing circuits, right? We thought that what we were doing was producing something, exploring areas that had never been touched on before.
Jim Montgomery was a founding member of the Canadian Electronic Ensemble, which is the oldest live electronic performing group in the world. He didn't know Mort's work because they were in different worlds. Mort was making commercial music, and Jim was in academia. But after he gave it a listen, I asked him what he thought.
It's really good. For that period, he's clearly a master of that particular instrument. The problem of how to get the same kind of expressivity that you can get that a violinist gets when they play a violin, or a pianist can get from a piano, was one of the first major difficulties for people who were trying to use analog synths as I prefer to think about them as extensions of traditional instruments rather than replacing traditional instruments.
Mm-hmm.
My appreciation for the technical ability, and because we were all working with the same difficulties.
And maybe those early difficulties are why Moog made the instrument more usable over time. He simplified the design so that it could be controlled with a keyboard and easy to use for live performances. But those later models didn't have the sonic range of the earlier system. And since the mid-90s, people have been going back to the modular synth for that classic sound.
A lot of that is just that it's hands-on. You can get your hands on it. You can actually make the connections. You can turn the knobs. You can do, and you can feel much like a person playing a traditional instrument can. You're playing a vibrato on a violin, you move your finger, and look at that. That's what happens, right? You push down harder on a key on a piano, and it gets louder. That visceral physical connection to the stuff is what you get with modular synths.
Even though the promise of a technological utopia was never fully realized, artists are still drawing from the sounds of that era. In the mid-1970s, Mort Garson shifted his focus from outer space to making music for houseplants and the people who love them. This is a song from Mort Garson's last album, Mother Earth's Plantasia. On the next episode, we'll talk about how a New York Times best-selling book inspired stacks of albums for plants and some by plants. We'll hear from an artist who was inspired by Mort to make music for her own plants.
One philodendron that was just sort of one really long strand.
And we'll ask Mort Garson's daughter what it was like to grow up with him.
So if he woke up early in the morning and wanted to buy a car, he would wake my mom and I up and we would leave immediately and we would go and buy a brand new car before the dealer even opened in our pajamas.
That was Day Darmay, Casalif, Jim Montgomery, Chuck Braverman, and Paul Findlay, who actually understands, like I mean really understands, what an oscillator does. If you want to know what they're up to these days, you can do that at canadalandshow.com/imp. I produced this episode with Angela Shackle with assistance from Braden Labonte. Our theme music is by Nathan Burley, with additional music by Carl Dieter. Big thanks to Matthew Fava and Nick Storing for your help with this episode. You can follow The Impostor on Twitter at Impster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aaliyah Pavani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Impostor, play it over the PA system at your workplace until they tell you to turn it off because they're sorry, but it's just not the kind of vibe they're trying to nurture in here. Okay? Okay.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.